Getting ready to take on spring? Make your first move with the reliable performance and power of Steel battery tools. From hedge trimmers and mowers to string trimmers and more, right now you can save $50 on select battery tool sets. Real Steel. Offer valid on select AK system sets through June 16, 2024. See participating retailer for details.
At JCPenney, fashion counts for everybody and every body. The weather is getting warmer, and it's time to swap my winter layers for fun, vibrant, and cool clothing. With so many fun things happening this spring, like Mother's Day and the Wind Down Tour, it's hard to find great-looking clothes that fit you just right. That's why I love JCPenney. JCPenney has so many stylish and comfortable options for so many different body types. I've been blown away by their selection, and everything hugs my body in all the right spots. Refresh your wardrobe this spring with style that gets you. Something to wear that fits your favorite moments of the season at prices that feel just as good. Discover brands that get you and put style and comfort first, like Worthington and Liz Claiborne for her, each in women's petite and plus sizes. Here, spring comes in all shapes, sizes, and colors. JCPenney, make everybody count.
Hosting this podcast, I've relied on one of my favorite Bible passages from the book of James, chapter 1, verse 19. It says in part, quote, "Be quick to hear, slow to speak, slow to anger," end quote. Welcome to the final episode of Black in the NFL. I'm your host, Clifton Brown. During 10 episodes of this podcast, I've tackled emotional topics impacting the NFL, like racism, players protesting against social injustice, and police brutality. I've wanted every guest to feel comfortable enough to talk candidly. I've intentionally let my guests carry the conversation, hoping they would feel free to reveal what was truly in their hearts and minds. This final episode of Black in the NFL is entitled, "Where We're Going." My guests are two of the most powerful people in the NFL, Troy Vincent, NFL Executive Vice President of Operations, and DeMarie Smith, Executive Director of the NFLPA. These two influential black men will discuss how the league has addressed diversity, racism, players' rights, and other issues, and their visions for race in the NFL in 2021 and beyond. Then we'll close Black in the NFL by replaying some of the strongest opinions we heard during the first 9 episodes, statements made by people who challenged us to broaden our thinking. My motivation to do this podcast was reinforced last year after NFL Commissioner Roger Goodell admitted the league was wrong for not listening to its players sooner when they protested against police brutality. I was disappointed that Goodell did not mention Colin Kaepernick specifically in that video, but I was encouraged that Goodell was finally taking a public stance in support of players in a league where around 70% of the players are black.
It has been a difficult time for our country, in particular, black people in our country. First, my condolences to the families of George Floyd, Breonna Taylor, Ahmaud Arbery, and all the families who have endured police brutality. We, the National Football League, condemn racism and the systematic oppression of black people. We, the National Football League, admit we were wrong for not listening to NFL players earlier and encourage all to speak out and peacefully protest. We, the National Football League, believe black lives matter.
Our first guest, Troy Vincent, is a former Pro Bowl cornerback who has climbed the ladder at the league office. He has direct access to the commissioner and had a candid conversation with Goodell before his video went viral. It's possible that Vincent could be NFL commissioner one day, and for months, I've wanted to know what he told Goodell before he decided to release that Black Lives Matter video.
My thought around that is, and when we had that discussion prior to leading up to it, don't say it if you don't mean it. Don't say it if you don't mean it. And I knew in his heart, I've been working with him. If you say this, we as a people, we hold you accountable to it. So don't say it if you don't mean it. And I knew it in his heart. I looked at him. I work with him on a daily basis. And I got a check in my spirit every day. And it was just simple. Before you do this, don't do it if you don't mean it.
And his immediate reaction, Troy, was to that?
Well, you can almost see the emotion. You can see the emotion well up, because I've been sitting across the table since my early days, my playing days, on this topic with him as a player. It seems to always come back. Obviously, he's our leader. He's the leader of our game. But this is a shared responsibility all. But I saw the emotion. And it goes, what else do I have? It's almost like he has to keep proving himself. And it's like, no, we got to do this together. But you're about to go on and make a video. You're about to make a public statement. Don't say it if you don't mean it.
Our second guest, DeMarie Smith, has spent years negotiating with Goodell and the owners in his role as executive director of the NFL Players Association since 2009. To say that Goodell and Smith don't always see eye to eye would be an understatement. When Smith hears the NFL taking a more public stance to support his players and to push for diversity and inclusion, he says it's about time.
How much evidence did you see of maybe the league, for lack of a better word, changing perspective or opening up its attitude or changing its attitude regarding players and them speaking out on social justice?
I always come back to you can hear what the words people are using. I can't look into somebody's heart. You can't look into somebody's heart. Clearly, the league made a conscious decision this year to embrace both the position and the voices that they had been hearing from their players for years. And I think that's a good thing. At the same time, however, I still am happier and more pleased that the players have been on the right side of this issue even before it became popular, right? I was reminded with the passing of Rush Limbaugh, it was 2009, probably 3 months after I was elected into this job, where Rush Limbaugh was leading a consortium to buy an NFL team. That didn't sit well with our players. I came out publicly saying that him owning an NFL team didn't represent the best at what NFL players stood for and what they stood for in their communities. You know, that was 2009. So to find the league becoming more open and supportive of players' voices in 2020 is good to see. But if I had to choose between the two, I'm much happier that our players have decided to take stands and use their voices for social change and not waited for the league to join them.
So how much progress has the NFL made over the last 12 months regarding diversity, social justice issues, and inclusion? We've seen some landmark events during the 2020 season. Players from around the league knelt and spoke out about social justice stronger than ever before without receiving the same backlash they did 4 years ago. 3 black general managers were hired, and other black GM candidates like Jerry Reese and Rick Smith were finalists. Jason Wright of the Washington Football Team, a guest on episode 8 of this podcast, became the first black team president in NFL history. The Tampa Bay Buccaneers became the first Super Bowl winner with 3 black coordinators: offensive coordinator Byron Leftwich, defensive coordinator Todd Bowles, and special teams coordinator Keith Armstrong. The Buccaneers also had 2 female coaches on the sidelines, Lori Locus and Maral Jafatafar, while Sarah Thomas became the first woman on a Super Bowl officiating crew. One of the game's biggest stars, black quarterback Deshaun Watson, is using his power to reportedly try to force a trade. Patrick Mahomes, another black quarterback, went to his second straight Super Bowl, and along with Ravens quarterback Lamar Jackson, looks like the game's present and future. However, there are still many shortcomings. Just 2 of the 18 NFL head coaches hired since the end of the 2018 season have been black: David Culley of the Houston Texans and Brian Flores of the Miami Dolphins. Only 2 more have been minorities: Ron Rivera of the Washington Football Team, who is of Hispanic descent, and Robert Saleh of the New York Jets, who is Arab American. Meanwhile, there was a recent NFL hiring episode that quickly backfired on the Jacksonville Jaguars. New head coach Urban Meyer hired Chris Doyle as his strength coach, even though Doyle was accused of making numerous racist remarks and bullying and belittling players during his long tenure at the University of Iowa. Meyer claimed he had vetted Doyle thoroughly, but many people such as Rod Graves weren't convinced. Graves is executive director of the Fritz Powder Alliance, and he was a guest on episode 6 of this podcast. Graves immediately called out Meyer for hiring Doyle, who resigned under pressure the next day after widespread criticism. Quote, "It is simply unacceptable to welcome Chris Doyle into the ranks of NFL coaches," Graves said before Doyle resigned. Graves continued, "Doyle's departure from the University of Iowa reflected a tenure riddled with poor judgment and mistreatment of black players. His conduct should be as disqualifying for the NFL as it was for the University of Iowa." Urban Meyer's statement, quote, "I've known Chris for close to 20 years," end quote, reflects a good old boy network that is precisely the reason there is such a disparity in employment opportunities for black coaches. Let's bring in DeMaurice Smith, who is not convinced that the majority of the 32 NFL owners are as comfortable with diversity and supporting social justice issues as he would like them to be.
Now, during your tenure as NFLPA president, have you noticed owners becoming more comfortable with the idea that players are going to speak out about racism and social justice? Or do you still think that's something that a lot of owners or club executives would rather not have their players do?
You know, I have a lot of private conversations with owners, but let's put it this way. I think you've seen the league and Roger take a formal stance that is more supportive, more inclusive, and more open to diversity. I think that is a good formal step by the league. I'm not sure it's shared by all of the owners.
As black men who are also fathers, diversity in the NFL is extremely important to Vincent and Smith. They want the NFL to be more inclusive at the coaching and executive level, giving the next generation more opportunities. Let's hear again from Vincent, who believes more people in the league, owners, executives, and coaches, are willing to listen when racial equality, diversity, and inclusion are discussed. He believes genuine progress is being made. Troy, during the past 9 months, when there's been so much focus on diversity and racial equality in the NFL, what things have you been most encouraged by that have taken place in the league?
The willingness to listen, the willingness to have a better understanding around the issues, the pain, the discouragement of both black men and women, and in particular black men. That willingness to listen, to have a better understanding, but also sit at the table, Zoom calls, conversations around solutions. And how do we as an industry, because we don't own it, but how do we become better? How do we become part of the solution to ending racism or systemic racism? So I've been extremely encouraged, frankly, not throughout just past year, but we had some visuals that I think opened everyone's eyes, because we have been doing some work in this area, but I just think 2020 and some of the things that we saw play out nationally, we were able to take a deeper dive.
Now, what things have you been most discouraged by?
I'm not discouraged, because I remain optimistic, Cliff, because I've seen, not just internally, but externally, I've seen levels of progress. And in particular, as we think about our industry, the National Football League, I've been part of building a true plan in educating club owners, educating clubs around the importance of having a true diversity and equity plan. I've seen a collective effort around identification of talent at all levels, football and business. I've seen, as best we can, the identification and the networking of people of color in every aspect and every level of our business. I've seen policy changes that were significant. There were some policies that have been put in place for decades that did not allow mobility of coaches, but it disproportionately affected coaches of color. I saw those walls crash. I saw those policies now go to the shredder. And I saw club owners, the commissioner, Chairman Rooney, Dasia Smith, put together a plan, again, rectify. It's been a reform of our system. So I remain optimistic. The baton's in our hand. I remain hopeful. Even as this hiring season comes to a close, not happy with the results from a head coach, but there were so many other positives. We got a new president and with the Washington football team, some new GMs, David Culley, Robert, Anthony Lynn, still relevant, Raheem. Eventually, we want to normalize that, but there's been some progress there that we can build on. So I remain optimistic and hopeful.
Right. And that led me to my next question. Some of the things that have happened in the hiring cycle. Do you walk away from this year's hiring cycle feeling that the process was honestly more inclusive or not?
I do. And our data, and we would say, hey, if you can't measure, it doesn't mean anything. Our data says so. And I do believe, because when you take a look at the individuals that were actually part of consideration, we moved away. I do believe we moved away from what many would consider sham interviews, or why is a team interviewing him when he really doesn't, or she may not really have an opportunity or a real shot. When you look at the names this year and you go back and speak to those individuals, which we need to do a full analysis of that, but Marvin Lewis and the Jim Caldwells and the Todd Bowles, we feel the Patrick Grahams, the Aaron Glenns, it was a good cycle. So we saw an increase when we look at Martin Mayhew's back, Terry Fontenot, Jerry Reese, who many are still puzzled. Jerry Reese was back in the interview process. Didn't land one, but young individuals like JoJo Wooden, Lewis Riddick, Rick Smith, these are our best of the best. So I say that because I'm looking at it from a totality standpoint. Again, not happy with the results from head coaches. Expectation that we all felt like it would be more without putting a number on it. Made progress on the GM side. But remember also, I look at the fall from the black head coach. If we look at history, typically head coach gets removed, he becomes a position coach or out of the game. We have liked to see Raheem retain a head coaching position. Anthony Lynn, they're coordinators. Marcus Berry's now an offensive coordinator in Indy. We should not discount that progress.
Several people who've been on this podcast have insisted that Commissioner Goodell, yourself, the league office, they're committed to improving diversity at all levels of the NFL, and obviously they are making a hard push to make that happen. So what changes do you think the NFL still needs to make in its approach to diversity and racial equality?
So, Cliff, this is what I would say, and I've shared this with the commission over the last few days, if we've just talked about it. It is, our hiring cycle's almost over. We've got a few more openings there. And then this is where we assess properly. We analyze, and now we listen. Before we go back into how does this work into our strategy, because the 7-point mobility plan that we laid out a year ago, that's our plan. And we're committed to that plan. So now it's time for us, as the cycle completely closes, now we assess. Let's interview the clubs who interviewed the prospects. When I say prospects, meaning those coaches that they were considering, those GMs that they were considering. Let's also interview Marvin, Eric Bieniemy, Raheem, Leslie Frazier. Let's do a true analysis and assessment of what did they learn? Same thing with club owners. Why didn't you hire? Then we do a complete analysis, and then we map that. It's so important that we map that to our 7-point plan, which I laid out. When we finish going into the summer of 2020, remember that 7-point mobility plan, club and league education, club and league diversity plans, talent identification, pipeline development and networking opportunities, policy changes. We now have a universal data collection. And then that final point in that 7-point mobility plans was reporting and measuring. That's where we are today.
Obviously, you know, I have so many conversations about diversity and the importance of it. Why do you feel that it's important to have more Black coaches, coordinators, and executives? Why is that so important for the league? Is it more a matter of improving the product? And how much of it is because it's the morally right thing to do?
It's the both and. It's not an either or. We have to get to a place where we're doing the right thing for the right reasons. And Cliff, when I have the opportunity to participate in these discussions, it's important that I represent people like yourself, our community, with dignity, honor, professionalism, to be an example of what we can, what we are. And that is so important that we represent the possibilities of what it could be or should be. Diversity is a fact, but inclusion is a choice. And when we look around our tables, when we're doing business internally, externally, we always have to ask ourselves, who's missing? Who's missing from the table? From gender to people of different nationalities, that's inclusion. So it's never an either or, it's a both and. And trying to get people starts with education. That is good business. It's the right thing to do for the right reasons.
Is there a disconnect on some level, or has there been a disconnect between the NFL's owners' commitment to diversity and the league's office's commitment to diversity?
I got asked that question yesterday. People have made a broad generalization that the owners or club owners are not, this is not important to them. And that's false. That's a generalization. That's a general statement. Because the men and women that I work with on these policy changes, on programs, on rewards, on education, they're club principal owners. Kim Begula, Arthur Blank, Michael Bidwell, Javier Loya, Sherman Rooney. These are club owners. We just got to keep moving in advance. And we would say we got to keep moving the chains and bring more people into the camp. And that doesn't come from shaming people. History tells us shaming people gets you nowhere. We got to continue to educate, continue to extend love and peace, and explain the why. And why this is good for us, which ultimately football is part of an American fabric, why is good for the game and our communities.
The past year has made it pretty clear that more NFL players are no longer willing to shut up and play, which was the title of episode 1 of Black in the NFL. More players seem comfortable with using their place in the public eye to create change. Even if some fans turn their back on a league where more players choose to speak out, Vincent believes the NFL will continue to back its players speaking out against social injustice. Even when fans return to the stands in a post-pandemic world and can boo or voice their displeasure more loudly when players protest. Now, is the league willing to lose some sponsors moving forward if, you know, there's more blowback as far as protesting and kneeling?
Well, the objective is just to educate the fan. And we got to find the right balance. We got to remember, Cliff, we are an entertainment property that puts on a live event called football. We're not a social justice group. So finding that balance, and I've always taken that position as a player and now as an executive, we got to strike the right balance because people are tuning in to watch the best athletes in the world play a game that they love. I do believe we working together with the players, the fan input's critical. Why? Because they drive the game. And finding that right balance, sponsors as well, of making sure that we are part of the critical conversation in the community. We can't be tone deaf to what's going on. We play a role. Look at the men who play the game and who coach the game. So the threat of losing, I think it's about educating our sponsors. And what we found, many of our sponsors, if not all, are playing some kind of role in the community around social justice issues.
Some have mentioned you as a possible next commissioner, Troy. How do you react if you hear that?
I've always been finish serve where you are. I have so much work on my table currently right now. I want to serve the commissioner that's in place, which is Commissioner Cadell, the best I can. I'm not getting ahead of myself and my colleagues. I always say that. They go, why? You sound like you just dismissed it. I'm here to serve today. I don't know what tomorrow brings. I'm not sure where the Lord's going to lead me. But today, I love serving our current commissioner. I love serving the game.
In regards to race in the league, I guess if you could sum up what's your ultimate vision regarding diversity and equality for the league in 10, 15, 20 years, what do you see and what does that vision look like?
So as I tell young people, see the possibilities. If you can see it, you can achieve it. And I've lived my life spiritually through my faith of standing on faith, things that I'm not able to see, but I'm just believing in. When I think about diversity, equity, and inclusion in our sport, that we really are a reflection of the American fabric of people, that we are a parallel. We represent the communities. And what is that? The community is made up of all people. When we look at our fans, we should make gender and women on our sidelines as coaches, as officials, front office executives, Black men and women as doctors and engineers and analysts. We should make that a norm, but it has to be intentional, and our efforts have to be intentional. We can't be happy with a little bit of progress, and now we go back to complacency. But the future should represent what America looks like of all walks of life. We always talk about football for all. Again, diversity is a fact. Inclusion is a choice. Who are we willing and choosing to bring into our family?
Moving forward, I believe it's imperative for the NFL to keep diversity and social justice at the forefront of its thinking. As Doyle's hiring showed, it's easy to slip back into old habits. Kaepernick took a bold stand to protest during the national anthem, but it has apparently cost him his NFL career. The world became more open to discussing racism, social justice, and police brutality in 2020. But it took the murder of George Floyd, Ahmaud Arbery, Breonna Taylor, and others for many to be moved enough to protest, or at least be okay with others protesting. Let's bring back Smith, who has proven that he doesn't shy away from having contentious battles with the NFL and its owners as he fights on behalf of players. However, as Smith looks towards the NFL's future, he reminds players that when they speak out on social justice or challenge the league's long-standing ways of doing business, they will sometimes risk paying a heavy price.
It appears that when each year that goes by and Colin Kaepernick's not in the league, that he may have sacrificed his NFL career because he peacefully protested and spoke out about police brutality and social injustice. What has the union learned from his saga to help other players moving forward when they want to speak out against social injustice?
Yeah, I mean, the union's job here is to protect them legally if we have evidence that they are being blackballed or colluded. And we were a part of the lawsuit that Colin brought against owners of the National Football League. But, you know, Cliff, the other thing that I think that it's important for the union to make clear to players is while certainly he paid a high price, no one should ever think that taking bold stands sometimes doesn't cost careers, right? You and I are probably old enough, a little bit older than most the average age of our players. We understand clearly because we can remember when Muhammad Ali took his stance and it cost him the better part of the prime of his career. You and I know that John Carlos and Tommy Smith paid a huge price when they took their stand being expelled from the Olympic Village. We know that Jackie Robinson endured things that players today don't have to endure. If you and I could come up with a world where we knew you could take brave stands and yet that no one would ever end up a martyr, You and I would love that world. But you and I also know that whether it was Rosa Parks or Medgar Evers or four young girls who lost their lives in a bombing, the murder of Dr. King, the murder of Malcolm X, who among us wouldn't love to have a world where we knew it was free of martyrdom? It's not. So the role of the union, I think, is to protect our players and to pursue every legal avenue we have if we think they're being targeted or discriminated against. But more importantly, to teach them that brave stances have been taken by many, many people before them. And some of those people paid an ultimate sacrifice.
Yeah, I'm sure you hear this because I hear it. What do you say to people, fans, or people in general who say, I just want to escape thinking about social justice issues when I watch football. I don't want to see players speaking out. What do you say to people who say that to you?
I always go back to Neil Postman's book, Entertaining Ourselves to Death. We're in a country where I think you can make a pretty good argument that we've escaped too much, tried to be entertained too much, and tried to avoid having real conversations about what's happening in our community way too much. At what point does anybody believe that the game of football was stopped, interfered with, or supplanted because of a player using his or her voice? Exactly the opposite happened, right? Mm-hmm. Every one of our games went off on time. Every one of them played to a winner or a loser or a tie. Every fan got exactly the same sporting event that they wanted to see. So I come back to sort of a more pointed question to those people. Because none of that interfered with the game, it just seemed to me that you would rather see somebody go perform for you or dance for you. Those days are over.
Now, we did see in an NBA a few games not played during the bubble in protest. Could you ever envision something like that happening in the NFL?
It might. And look, you talk about the consequences of that, right? The players would have to know that if they decided not to play, the team could take the position that they were in breach of their contract, or the team could take the position that they are not going to pay them for that game. And to me, the question isn't, only whether that could happen in the National Football League. I think that it could. But every player needs to take into consideration that you're doing that in order to use your voice to make a point, but it might come at a cost. And by the way, you might decide that it's worth the cost, right? Mm-hmm. And so when those NBA players walked off the court, they made a strong decision about what they wanted to do. They also made a decision a few days later to come back and play, and that's fine. But going back to the perspective of the fan, I'm not sure any fan's ticket entitles them to that athlete becoming less of a three-dimensional person than the person watching in the stands, right? Fans in the stands clap through the national anthem. Fans in the stands sometimes don't pay attention to the national anthem. It's awfully weird to me that we've never had a conversation about them. We're only having a conversation about what players are doing before the game.
Now, for the last several weeks, I've been hearing and reading stories and reports about Deshaun Watson being unhappy with some decisions the Texans have made. There have been reports about Russell Wilson reportedly not being happy about some personnel decisions the Seahawks have made. Do you think we're moving toward an era where more prominent players in the NFL will seek to have more influence about how their franchises run and where they play via trade requests or holdouts?
I don't know whether we're moving to that place or not. I think that we should have moved to that place long ago. NBA players seem to take all sorts of positions, not only about the structure in terms of their contracts, but what's going on with personnel decisions. Now, you can complain about that or like that or not like that, but you and I both know that that's a fact, right? I think NFL players have the ability to use power, just like NFL owners have the ability to use power. When NFL owners want to trade you, or NBA owners want to trade you, they trade you. When they want to limit your playing time, they limit your playing time. Again, it's their exercise of power. When basketball players or NFL players who are free agents or have not signed their contract hold out or refuse to come to camp, somehow the whole conversation now turns into that guy is not a team player. That guy isn't doing what's best for his team. He's just acting selfishly. In those situations, the player is utilizing his power. Again, it just seems to be a dichotomy between the acceptance of an owner using his power and a castigation of a player when the player chooses to use his power, right? Mm-hmm. They're both utilizing what power they have at their fingertips. It's just the media does a pretty good job of making one selfish and making the other one prudent and smart. Now you understand why we have such dust ups at the National Football League between me and everybody else, because nobody pays me on that side at all. So I think the closer we get to speaking truth to power and calling things as it is, the better. You might not agree with it, but fine. Mm-hmm. Everybody can voice their opinion. But I just think that where we are in sport today, it does serve as a convening of people in America to come together. But I don't think that our convening power should ever come at the expense of our players' authenticity.
Now, about 70% of NFL players are Black. 0% of NFL owners are Black. How much do you think, I'll say it this way, potential Black ownership down the line is important for the league as far as to change the culture and maybe the thinking of overall ownership in NFL?
I don't know the answer to that question. You know, it seems to me that there's two ways of looking at it. Do you want more diverse owners in the league because you think it makes for a prettier picture of the ownership group? Or do you think that having more diversity will result on its own, result in a more diverse and inclusive league and front office jobs, league office jobs, head coaching jobs? Well, I think we would be kidding ourselves if we thought that simply by increasing the diversity of ownership that you will magically arrive at the optimal level of diversity, inclusion in the National Football League. And I think there's just one recent example to drive that home. Shad Khan is a person of color. He's the owner of the Jacksonville Jaguars, and their head coach hired a strength and conditioning coach who allegedly demeaned and insulted African-American players and was pushed out of his job in Iowa. So that's an example of a owner of color either allowing or not knowing that his head coach was hiring someone who had, let's just be charitable, a less than optimal viewpoint about Black players that he had previously coached. So I'm not sure I'm just going to be happy with us reaching nirvana simply because we have more owners of color. It seems to me that we, like most companies in America, regardless of your ownership and who's in your C-suite, companies who have done a good job of diversity and inclusion, like for example, this union, which is incredibly diverse, both women and race, it wasn't by accident. Mm-hmm. We insist on not only looking for the best talent and retaining the best talent, but also looking for and retaining the best talent from a diverse pool of candidates. And because we are relentlessly focused on both diversity and excellence, we've achieved probably the most diverse sports head office in the country that also operates at an extremely high level.
You know, obviously it's your job to fight for all players, you know, as head of the union, but as a Black man, as a father, having experienced your own life experience, how much of your fighting for players, fighting for racial equality, fighting for social justice is kind of a personal thing for you?
I don't have the luxury of divorcing the fact that I'm a Black man in America in a business where every now and then you still find yourself fighting for just the right to belong. I've been a lawyer for a really long time. I've been fortunate to do extremely well at the Department of Justice, do extremely well being a partner at a major law firm, negotiated now 2 collective bargaining agreements. We sit at the top of the revenue stream in football. And I'd be lying to you if I didn't know that when I'm walking in to a bargaining room with ownership that doesn't look like me, that there aren't people there who are still questioning whether I belong. I use that as fuel. I use that as fuel for my kids. I use that as a mission focus for our organization. And it is certainly not lost on me that the battles that we continue to fight as all players sometimes are still battles rooted in race and class. And I don't see that changing in the near future. And it probably is one of the reasons why I bring a little bit of heat to the job, but I'm not going to apologize for it. It seems to me that to ignore that fact is to ignore the very essence of America's struggle with race. And it would be to ignore the fact that we are continuing to fight some of the battles that my parents fought, your parents fought, my grandparents fought, and what's likely going to be battles that my kids and my grandkids are going to fight. Given the choice between ignoring that and embracing that, I gratifyingly choose the latter.
As promised, we're going to end this episode of Black in the NFL by hearing sound bites from some of our distinguished guests who spoke on previous episodes. Here's former Ravens tight end Ben Watson on why he didn't kneel when he played.
If I knelt for police brutality, which I believe there is, if I knelt for racial inequality, which I believe we still deal with, I didn't see a time in the foreseeable future where I would ever be able to get up.
Wow. John Jay College professor Dr. Gloria Brown Marshall on the importance of exercising the right to vote.
For people to abstain and say, I'm going to sit this one out. Well, brother, sister, you cannot sit this one out. You cannot play 2-year-old peekaboo games that you cover your eyes and the world disappears. You are in this world. You are playing a role. And if you don't play a role, then you're going to get played.
Ravens Hall of Famer Ozzie Newsome on growing up in the segregated South.
I was playing against this corner and he called me everything. I mean, all of the words that, you know, you and I both have heard our lives, you know what? And I just kept beating him, you know? And at the end of the day, he did a lot of talking, but I did a lot of scoring. You know? We would go out on the field. I remember the very first time, I think I was the last person that was chosen. You know, now I would say probably a week later or 2 weeks later, I was the first person that was chosen. You know, but so you understood that, but then you allowed your abilities to speak for you. You know, yeah, I was a person of different color, but my abilities were the one that did a lot of my talking.
Social activist Dr. Harry Edwards on NFL Commissioner Roger Goodell's video and Colin Kaepernick.
First of all, the first time Cap sat on the cooler in that preseason game, I went into the locker room at the San Francisco 49ers and got his jersey and his shoes, had him autograph them, and I sent them to Lonnie Bunch, who was then curator of the National Museum for African American History and Culture. And I told him to put them in a kiosk right between Ali and Smith and Carlos because Kaepernick was going to be the face of this generation of athletes. And Lonnie said, well, how do you know? And my response was, because the analysis is correct. I knew exactly and precisely where that was headed. I also talk to Roger on a regular basis. Troy Vincent and Roger Goodell, they are eminently decent people. Roger is an individual who is at the helm of the ship of the NFL, but there are 32 guys behind him wearing captain's hats, and all of them are talking at the same time. He's in a tough position, but that's what they pay him to do. So I don't have any sympathy for him, but I do try to advise him in terms of what I think are creditable steps that he can take to deal with this situation. When he came out with his statement, he did not consult me. But on the other hand, sometimes he uses me like a lawyer. He doesn't come to me before he commits the murder. He comes to me after he commits the murder and say, how do I clean this mess up? So this is one of those instances where that would have been a statement that I would not have advised him to make. And if he was going to make a statement, he should have used Kaepernick's name. He should have came out and said, I understand this situation. I'm the commissioner of the league. I do not hire players. I think that Kaepernick should be in the league. Mouthing Black Lives Matter doesn't mean you get it. White people will get Black Lives Matter when they've changed the system, when we've shifted from the pain of the Black community to the problems embedded in the human and institutional relationships in the white community. And those changes have been made, and they can look back and say, wow, we get it. That was some sick stuff we were involved in. But until then, just mouthing Me Too doesn't mean they get it. And when you mouth Me Too and don't even use the name of the individual who is most central to the situation you're addressing, like Kaepernick, then you really don't get it. We're in the same situation now that we've been in since 2017, when Kaepernick was not picked up by a team. Cap is still on the street. All of the PSAs, all of the sympathetic statements, all of the money they may pledge to social justice issues won't mean very much. In point of fact, it will stand in stark contradiction to the reality, if not in abject hypocrisy, as long as Kaepernick is on the street.
Social activist Richard Lapchick on his advice for Commissioner Roger Goodell.
I would advise him, keep listening to the players, hear their voices, understand that they are, which I think he does now, multidimensional human beings. And I think this is one of the things about athlete activism that has finally captured the spirit of players is, you know, they used to be asked, do you think you'll be recovered from this injury and be able to play on Sunday? Think the team will win the conference championship? Will we play in the Super Bowl? Now they're being asked about wealth in America and the disparities in educational systems and the disparities in healthcare systems and in the COVID crisis, you know, the disproportionate impact on Black and brown communities from the plague in this country at the moment. It feels good to be treated as a multidimensional human being. And I think Roger Goodell and the league office is now doing that. And we're going to see more, hopefully, more of a partnership in the future. And I would encourage him to even expand that further.
Hall of Fame quarterback Warren Moon on how he felt when he wasn't drafted by the NFL to play quarterback.
I loved that I had an opportunity to play pro ball. I loved that I had an opportunity to continue to play quarterback, but I hated the fact that I had to leave my own country to go do it. I hated the fact that my own country didn't realize that I had the ability to play the position. So there was bitterness on top of loving the opportunity to just continue to keep playing a game that I loved.
Ravens quarterback Lamar Jackson on today's Black quarterbacks changing the game. Are we past the point of with what you and Mahomes doing, Deshaun, Russell Wilson, the negative stereotypes of Black quarterbacks, or do you think there's still some of that going on?
Oh, it's going to still be some of that going on, you know, but it's dying down a lot, you know, because each and every Sunday or whenever any one of us play, you know, we showing up and we put on the show. You know, we're not just out there just playing football and just doing anything. We out there winning games, and I feel putting our team in best situations, you know. So I guess we changed the narrative as we go on, just like the guys before us did.
Rod Graves, executive director of the Fritz Pollard Alliance, on the false narrative that there aren't enough qualified Black head coach and GM candidates.
One of the fallacies that we've heard, you know, over the last couple of years is that the pipeline for Black candidates is not deep enough. And every time I hear something like that, I almost want to jump up out of my chair and start swinging. Because these are the, you know, I can go through a list of people.
Hall of Fame coach Tony Dungy on why more Black offensive coordinators aren't getting the opportunity Byron Leftwich got in Tampa Bay.
I think so much of it is who you know, who you've been around. You know, Bruce Arians coached Byron Leftwich. So he knows Byron Leftwich. And when he's looking for an offensive coordinator or a quarterback coach, well, who's the best guy that I've been around? And he turns to Byron Leftwich. That wouldn't have happened had he not coached him. So that's where the bias is, I think. Not that we can't do it. We haven't been given those opportunities.
NFL Network's Judy Batista on the struggle for more minority head coaches to be hired.
They're sort of at the tearing their hair out stage of what do we have to do to make this better? Because I do think, you know, a few years ago when the Rooney Rule went in, it took a little while to gain traction. There were owners that were resistant, but then we got to 8 minority coaches in the league. So that's 25%, which is still not commensurate to the number of minority players in the league, but it's much better than where we are now. Yes. And then they backslid. And so now I think they are just sort of at this point where they're like, what do we have to do? We just can't keep going like this year after year where you don't have any minority hires or one, you know, when you have 8 jobs open every year.
Myself, or why I wanted to do this podcast. In my 40 years as a sports writer, including 19 years at the New York Times, I've had conversations with legendary athletes like Michael Jordan and Tiger Woods, and today's young stars like Lamar Jackson. But recently, I've had more candid conversations about race with athletes than ever before. Because as Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. once said, we may have all come on different ships, but we're in the same boat now. After listening to this podcast, maybe you'll understand why athletes won't just shut up and play. Or maybe you won't. But I'm hoping you'll listen, because I believe more understanding leads to more unity. That's still how I feel. We've tackled some controversial subjects, but I've learned plenty. And I will continue to work on my own journey to become a more inclusive person. The struggle for Black people to achieve equality in the NFL, and more importantly in American society, has never been a 2-minute drill. It's been a long, hard battle that has lasted for generations and continues today. I'm encouraged that so many young adults who will lead this next generation seem more willing to talk about race and inclusion than my generation was. I'm encouraged by the open and honest conversations I've had about race with Black and white friends, coworkers, and people I don't even know over the last 8 months. To those who have listened to Black in the NFL, I sincerely thank you. To those who are committed to making our world more inclusive and less discriminatory, we need you. Don't be discouraged. Stay optimistic. My thanks to the Ravens organization and to Blue Wire for supporting me in this project. I could not have done it without you. As I continue to engage in conversations about race in both my professional and personal life, I will try my best to be quick to hear, slow to speak, and slow to anger, even when I disagree with another person's point of view. Be safe and be blessed. Black in the NFL is powered by Blue Wire. The show is produced and edited by Noah Eberhardt and executive produced by Michelle Andres, Ryan Mink, John Yales, and Peter Moses. Tune into the Ravens Podcast Network for 2 other podcasts, The Lounge, hosted by Garrett Downing and Ryan Mink, and What Happened to That Guy, hosted by John Eisenberg.
At JCPenney, fashion counts for everybody and everybody. The weather is getting warmer and it's time to swap my winter layers for fun, vibrant, and cool clothing. With so many fun things happening this spring, like Mother's Day and the Wind Down Tour, it's hard to find great looking clothes that fit you just right. That's why I love JCPenney. JCPenney has so many stylish and comfortable options for so many different body types. I've been blown away by their selection, and everything hugs my body in all the right spots. Refresh your wardrobe this spring with style that gets you. Something to wear that fits your favorite moments of the season at prices that feel just as good. Discover brands that get you and put style and comfort first, like Worthington and Liz Claiborne for her, each in women's petite and plus sizes. Here, spring comes in all shapes, sizes, and colors. JCPenney, make everybody count.
Hey guys, you know what this playground could use? A wine country, huh?
A redwood forest would be cool.
Ski slopes!
Wait! Did we just invent California?
Discover why California is the ultimate playground at visitcalifornia.com.